I'd like to thank Factor for sponsoring this episode. It's been great to hear from so many folks who have used the offer so far and had their meal times changed with Factor. Eating better is certainly easier with every meal fresh, never frozen, and ready to go in only 2 minutes. Factor gives you more than 35 different options each week to choose from, which includes keto, calorie smart, vegan, veggie, and more. Speaking as someone who has just recently changed my diet, that sort of flexibility is essential. Pancakes, smoothies, and more. You can discover a wide variety of easy options for the entire day, like breakfast, midday bites, and more. Factor is the perfect solution if you're looking for fast, premium options with no cooking required. I love that time saver. And you can sign up and save. They've done the math, and Factor is less expensive than takeout, and every meal is dietitian approved to be nutritious and delicious. Head to factormeals.com/UFO50 and use code UFO50 to get 50% off. That's code UFO50 at factormeals.com/UFO50 to get 50% off.
This is David Marler, UFO researcher, and you're listening to That UFO Podcast.
Well, that's fair. Kevin, I want to move into listener questions. Like I say, we have had a lot sent in to the podcast. I had to do a lot of culling here. So apologies if you don't hear your question. We'll get through as many of them as we can. They'll jump all over the place, but Kevin's been very generous with his time to get through these. So Kevin, first up, question from Newman. Newman says, at the 2021 conference of the AIAA, Kevin presented MWIR-LWIR footage of a mysterious trefoil-shaped craft seemingly shadowing a jet plane as recorded by UAPX engineer David Mason. What is UAPX current state of analysis and conclusions on the footage?
Yes, that was recorded by David Mason from his backyard. And it was an unknown object, trefoil-shaped, that was shadowing a jet airliner that was coming into land at the Seattle airport. So we're not really in a position to do more analysis on that. The problem is you have it was recorded on two FLIR cameras. We have the temperature from the infrared, so this thing is about 60 degrees below zero Fahrenheit, whereas the airplane was hot or much warmer, like in the 30s Fahrenheit. So it's a strange object because it wasn't visible in visible light. So that we also know. But it was recorded on two cameras. David Mason was just testing his equipment at the time, seeing what he could pick up. And he had two cameras operating some distance from each other, but their precise locations relative to one another aren't known. So we can't use it for triangulation to get a size or height. If that thing was about the same altitude as the jet airplane, then it's about the same size of a jet airplane, which is a little shocking. But this is another aspect of UAPs that is real, is that they often shadow airplanes. And they'll shadow passenger jets. The one seen off the coast between Los Angeles and Hawaii, one of the pilots noted that these objects had followed him for about 40 minutes on a trip from Los Angeles to Hawaii. So this is very common. Sometimes the pilots notice them, and it unnerves them because they don't know what they are. This is one of the reasons for studying this. This is probably, in my mind, probably the main reason, the best argument for studying these things is that these things are encountered by pilots. They're encountered by airline pilots who are responsible for the lives of 250 people in the back. They're encountered by Air Force and Navy pilots in battle, in wartime situations. They encountered them from the USS Roosevelt when they were doing bombing runs in 2015 in Syria. They would have to fly past UAPs and encounter UAPs, and then they'd have to go on their bombing run, which is why the Navy was so worried about this. This is really how it started. So these things are an air travel hazard, and pilots need to know what's in the air. That's a necessity. And if there are things that we don't know about that are in the air, we need to know what they are so the pilots can be educated so that they know what they're encountering. I don't want to be on a passenger jet and then have the pilot discover that we're being shadowed and then have something happen where the pilot decides he has to take some evasive maneuver. I don't want that situation. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you don't either. I fly a lot. That should not be happening, and we should make sure, you know, air safety is all about preventing possible accidents. So let's study these things and find out what they are. Instead of saying, oh, I'm sure it's all nothing. Well, it's not all nothing. It's something. It's something that's bothering pilots. Let's solve it from that perspective, which is why I think what the AIAA is doing is exactly right.
But another question.
To quick answer the question, sorry, because you've got a lot of them. We haven't been able to do more analysis on that video because we couldn't do any triangulation. We just have the unknown object that to me looks like a Klingon D5 warship and a passenger jet. So,
no, I appreciate that. Question, another one from Newman. Newman asked, is Kevin aware and has by chance any thoughts on the recently put online preprint by a collaboration of researchers who suggest there might be a shadow biosphere of proto life forms existing in the form of plasmas in Earth's outer atmosphere?
How interesting. Is this by, maybe this is by Ron Josephs or something? I'm not sure. I'm not sure what to think of this.
Yes, yes, I've got it up now. Yes.
Yeah. So I'm not sure what to think of this. They're suggesting something rather radical that plasmas can be alive, right? And I think that we probably don't, you know, we've studied one kind of life here on Earth as well, we're familiar with. And so we're extremely biased in thinking about what life is like. And when I was at NASA and continuing, still there are constantly conferences on trying to figure out how are we going to identify life when we encounter it. We don't know how to do that. You can't do it with a tricorder. There is no such thing. And there's no thing to test for life. So it's hard to know. And can plasmas be alive? I mean, could you have living plasmas on the surface of the sun? I can't answer that. I would have no idea. I don't know how it would work, but that's my ignorance. So that's what these guys are suggesting, that there is other forms of life here that we're not aware of yet, very possibly. And you're going to need some evidence to convince people. And it's going to be hard to do, but go for it. I'm not going to stop you. I think it's good to study things. That's what we do. That's what a scientist ought to do, study things.
There's a few more questions from Newman in the Patreon exclusive section, or sorry, not just Patreon, but the paid section that's a 10-minute exclusive at the end, folks. So if you're on any of those platforms, you'll hear a little bit more from Newman and a few others. But we'll carry on now. Kevin, Purple Rain, who is over in Vienna, asked via YouTube, and he wanted to say, I love what Dr. Knuth is doing and enjoyed his talk at Sol, but I watched it with my very scientific-minded son, and immediately he had three questions. So I think you've got a bit of a skeptic here from a scientific point of view,
right,
watching it along. So the first question was, Dr. Knuth talks about presumptions in the intro, but why didn't he list the presumptions he had to make for the calculations?
I didn't quite understand the question. Can you say that again?
So I'll read it, but I don't fully get it. So hopefully this makes sense to you.
Okay.
Dr. Knuth talks about presumptions in the intro, but why didn't he list the presumptions he had to make for the calculations? Does that make sense?
Oh, he talks about the presumptions and the what? What was that other word that you used?
In your intro, in the introduction to the talk, presumptions.
Let's see. I'm trying to figure out where I didn't list them. I probably stated them. I hope I did. I mean, there's the tic tac dropping, the presumptions there are that, yeah, that's a real physical object that's actually performing the maneuver. That's a presumption. That the objects were at about 28,000 feet. What I didn't describe there was that I considered there to be about a 10% error. So there's actually a distribution of positions ranging around 300 feet around that 28,000 feet when I do the calculation, which is why there's kind of a histogrammed result of the resulting accelerations. And I put in about a 10% error for the amount of time it took for it to fall as well. I figured a 10% error is, I don't know what kinds of errors their Spy 1 radar system has. That's going to be classified. I'm not going to be able to know that. So I used 10% thinking that 10 to 15% is basically what our students do in labs. So I'm going to hope that the Navy can at least do as well as our students do in labs. Give them 10%. And so that was where that came from. But yeah, that wasn't explicitly stated. So why I didn't list them in the talk is because I had, 25 minutes to speak, and I've got a lot of ground to cover. And I can go into all of the presumptions I make, which I would put in a scientific paper. You know, writing a scientific paper, they're there. But I don't have time to discuss all of that in the talk. Plus, it's boring. Nobody wants to hear all that anyway. So those are reasons to not do it in a presentation, but that's basically why.
And here's another question, again, from the same listener or viewer's son, who's scientifically minded. We've got a skeptic here, which I think is very fair.
That's good. Keep going.
So hopefully, again, this makes sense to you. Why did Dr. Knuth use a comparison of the energy the UFO had needed that did not state a unit? He said something like the energy amount can be compared to the nuclear output of the US, but did not state per hour, per day, per year. I guess the point is, when scientists go public with this topic, the bar for non-believers is very high, and they have to meet that in order to also convince them.
Ah, right. Okay, well, I did state the amount of power. That was one, what is it? What was it? It was 1,100 terawatts, I think I listed on the graph. So that's the amount of power output that would have been required for the UAP. You're right, I did not list the amount of nuclear power output for the United States, but it's more than 10, but 1.1 terawatts is much more than the nuclear power output of the United States. Yeah, I didn't list that. In the scientific paper, I did list the nuclear power output of the Palo Verde nuclear generating station in Arizona, which is the biggest one we have, and that is listed. Why did I not save the period of time? Because power is the amount of energy per time, and so that is how much energy you're putting out per second, and so that I don't need to tell you how long. If you want to know how much energy it was, then I would have to tell you how many joules were expended, and then then I'd have to compare that with amount of time for the nuclear power output of the US. But that's why I didn't list that, because power is energy per time.
Well, Purple Rain does say thank you for all the work you're doing. Warmest regards from Vienna. And hopefully, if your son has a real interest, maybe we can convert another skeptic if he goes and checks out the scientific papers himself.
Yeah, go read the papers, and then if you have questions, you can find me at the University at Albany website. My university email is there. Email me questions. That's perfectly fine. I'm happy to answer them.
Awesome. A question from Pugix. Why is Dr. Knuth dismissive of the psychic or mental aspect of the UFO phenomenon?
I'm not dismissive of it. I don't know how to study it. I don't understand it. And I would have a hard time focusing on that and then trying to make headway with fellow scientists. So this is a lot of this is about, you know, how do we actually go about studying these things? A lot of this is strategic in studying them in ways that you can get other people interested rather than alienating yourself. I could go off and try to study alien abductees and their, you know, what they say about aliens being telepathic, but I wouldn't have any friends. So, and so it would, that would be hard. And I'm not sure what to think about that. That's difficult. And then how do you study that? How do you actually study it? How do you handle it? I'm not there when they're being abducted. I can't hook them up with EEG equipment and wait for them to be abducted. There's no obvious way to study it. I don't know how to do so. So I'm not going to do that. I'm a physicist, so I'm going to study physics things. And that's my current plan of attack. See what if I can make headway into the physics of the objects that people are seeing rather than the other weird aspects. I'm not dismissive of them. I find them fascinating and weird, and I don't know what to think about them. But I think that studying them is a whole different ball of wax.
Well, here's a physics question for you from Kenneth Noisewater. Nice anchor.
Right, I can maybe handle that. Fingers crossed.
So my question in terms of physics, the highest Mach we have achieved or reached as humans on a manned aircraft, I believe, is 9.6 Mach or hypersonic. What is the rumored recorded or otherwise speed of a UAP that hasn't been explained by Chinese high hypersonic drones?
The highest speeds that I know of for UAPs are, well, about Mach 60. Although, although Daniel Kumbe had estimated the speeds of the JAL Airlines UFO that followed that airlines for 40 minutes in 1986 to be about 250,000 miles an hour, which I'm right now quick calculating into Mach speed because I can't do that in my head easily. So, yeah, so that's something like Mach 325. So Daniel Kumbe from the Niels Bohr Institute had put in his book Anomalous his calculations from the radar data from that JAL 1628 case. When I wrote about that in the paper, I put in estimates based on the summary of what the UFO was doing, not the actual radar data. And I state that in the paper, but he used the radar data and he found them to this large walnut-shaped craft, which was about 747s in length, estimated by the pilot, to be accelerating at about 10,000 Gs and having a maximum speed of about 250,000 miles an hour. Which is about Mach 325, which I quick calculated there because I'm on a computer. So I'm not doing this in my head. I'm not that good. And and keep in mind that 250,000 miles an hour, you can get to the moon in about 50 minutes. It's a 50-minute trip to the moon. You can go to the moon for lunch and come back in time if you had a craft like that. I want something like that. That would be great. Like I said earlier, I always wanted to go to the moon. I'll get a ride on one of these things. That would be fantastic.
I like to try and put things in perspective so I understand them. And Top Gun 2, for those who have seen it, Tom Cruise at the beginning has a experimental jet that he manages to push to 10.2, Mach 10.2, which is roughly 7,800 miles per hour. So then you're saying this thing potentially was going Mach 325.
That's a slow UAP, 7,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Actually, not the slowest, because the Nimitz case, what was strange about that initially is what they were tracking south at about 100 knots. It's about 120 miles an hour at 28,000 feet. So that's a slow UAP. But yeah.
Question from Stingray, because I've still got loads to get through. What is Kevin currently obsessed with?
UAPs to much my family's disappointment. UAPs and all the weird stuff associated with them. Yeah, how can you not be? This is really interesting stuff. I mean, usually when I went into physics as a grad student, I worried about what I would study. I thought, I would like to study gravity and relativity, but Einstein solved all that, so I don't even know what to do. I mean, what is there to study anymore? Well, there's this. This is a real mystery. I mean, how often do you get to encounter a real mystery? This is fun. That's what I'm obsessed with.
I can't disagree. Max over in Patreon asked, given unlimited funding, what would be your wish list for publicly available sensor systems to generate UFO data?
My wish list? Oh my God. I'd want it all. I'd want infrared cameras, ultraviolet cameras, regular visible cameras with different filters running at different exposure times, with polarizers, with all sorts of things. I want to detect electric and magnetic fields. I want to detect gravitational fields. I want particle detectors like our Cosmic Watch. I want them directional so I can aim them at things. Yeah, that would be a big wish list. I have a wish list. I have it written down. And if somebody has, you know, $20,000 they want to throw my way, I can fulfill a lot of that wish list, which would be great.
Brandon Fugel, Bob Bigelow, any of those listening or catching up on this, then throw some change.
Yeah, you can donate to UAPX. We're a nonprofit. Or donate to our university too. But you'd have to notify me first. Otherwise, they'll just take it and not give it to me.
No, that's fair enough. Question from Jeremy. Jeremy asks, do you think any of the UAP we have seen over the course of history may be biological in nature, for example, or i.e. alive?
That's a good question too. I don't know. UAP are, as I say in the Soul Talk, they're a class of phenomena. We don't know what we're dealing with, so they are not all the same things. And so I don't have an answer to that. And then some of them, you know, could be artificial biology, right? They could have been made by somebody else that are then now their own life forms. We don't really have a clue as to what kind of diversity of life we're dealing with in the universe here. I think there's a lot of surprises out there. I think we're going to be a lot of surprises and discoveries on the horizon. And I think that this is a great place to look.
I hope so. Questions from CS, they've just been answered recently and what Kevin's been saying. So thanks for sending those in. Mikey asks, theorizing using available technology in the public domain, is it possible to create a craft that can act like the Tic Tac or at least partly emulate its propulsion and movement, i.e. utilizing a nuclear power generator, waveguide? With recent metamaterial breakthroughs, do you think this is possible?
No, I wouldn't know how to do it. Yeah, there are some hypothesized methods using metamaterials are kind of like this magic, you know, box that we throw these things into. Metamaterials would have to have certain properties, and we don't know how to make these things yet. So I don't think it's possible. I don't think we know how to do this yet. There are people with ideas. We're trying new things, but I don't think we're quite there.
Speaking of new things, Peter Earnshaw, who likes to send in a question or two, Peter asks, do you believe that new physics, such as anti-gravity and zero-point energy, has been discovered, explored, and suppressed by US military spooks and their contractors? If so, for how long and what sort of discoveries?
I can't say. I would love to know, but I can't say that that's been done.
Here's one from Peter about Terra in the Sky, which is the documentary that UAPX was featured in. How confident are you that the evidence you gathered showed a wormhole in the clouds versus gamma radiation burst caused by electrical discharges due to normal weather and cloud movement and friction?
Well, we can't be confident there's a wormhole, mainly because we don't know what a wormhole would look like. So since you don't know what one would actually look like, we can't say that what we saw was a wormhole. So I think that's probably the best way to handle that part. I know that's a disappointing answer, but that's the situation. The little white dots that we see inside that hole in the clouds, those appear to be real objects. To me, they look like real objects. I suspect that it's possible that there are real objects that went up and went through the clouds and actually caused a false streak hole, and that's what we're filming there. But sadly, our FLIR cameras had been accidentally unplugged earlier in the evening and their batteries had run out. about a half hour before that happens. So we only have that short video from the UFO DAP system. It's a situation that me and Matthew are every few weeks we'll kick ourselves over again and again because that should not have happened. And nothing we can do about it. We missed it. We only collected a little bit of data. We got that large energy spike on the cosmic watch, which is anomalous and seems to be time associated with that event. But we don't know what happened there. It's interesting, whatever it is. We have tried to get footage from other cameras in the area. We've talked to other universities that were studying pollution to see if they had equipment up at the time. We have tried to collect infrasound. We have tried to, from infrasound detectors off the coast. We have tried to collect all sorts of data, any other data we can get our hands on, and we just haven't been able to. We've gotten radar data from weather radar from two systems that do correlate and show there's something interesting going on there, but that's all we've been able to do.
Josh asks, is Kevin aware of the anti-gravity research done by T. Townsend Brown in the 1940s, and does he think there's anything to it?
I am aware of it. I don't know a lot about the details. I've not really had time to dive into anti-gravity research. I do most of my work is exoplanet research. We've got a NASA grant to do that work now. And then theoretical work I do is more on foundational physics, on where the laws of physics come from. So I'm working at a different level there, but I've not really dived into the anti-gravity literature.
I like this question from Derek. This is a good one. I was jealous of thinking of this. So if light beams are used to lift and attract objects along their length, and I think he's thinking about abductions here, how would you make light act like a physical object and withdraw along itself as if it was in some kind of sleeve? What other forces of nature would have to come into play?
That's a good question. And yeah, so it sounds like you're asking about the light that's observed during when people claim to be abducted. And those are, we call that solid light. Those are what's described as solid light particles. They look like particles. Sometimes the beams are reported to come down and actually stop. They'll have a stopping point, which light does not do. There are things that they do that light doesn't do. So it's not clear that it's light. And I have a whole file on called solid light, and it's a file of just solid light cases, just people's descriptions of what appears to be solid light. No idea what it is, possibly a new kind of particle. I don't know, but that's something that's interesting to me and I'm aware of and paying attention to. When I can get anything on solid light, it gets thrown into that file, and hopefully something will spark an idea someday in the future.
Kevin, have you still got 10 minutes to give us for a couple more questions?
Sure, let's have some more questions. I like these. These are fun
awesome.
Questions.
And I have cut out so many, I'm not even kidding. Listen,
right.
just before we get there, for anyone who's listening on the free feeds, thank you very much for your time. The bonus section will be there for paid members. A few extra questions. There are free trials you can sign up to as well on Apple and Patreon. You don't even have to keep on. If you want to do it, listen and chuck it, then go for it. But from like a dollar, you can sign up and help support the podcast. So thank you very much. And there's all kind of bonus stuff on there. And before we get there, Kevin, just for the free feeds, what's coming next for you? And what are you currently working on?
What's coming next for me? Two things. The Tedescos they published their book, their recent book here, Nightcrawler, on their investigations off the coast of Long Island. And I am going there Wednesday. I'm just going to check out what they're doing and hang out with them for a night. That'll be great fun. So that's coming up this week. We're on break this week, so I have to find something fun to do. So that's what I'm going to do. Something related to my obsession, as somebody asked before. And what am I doing research-wise? I'm working on writing several papers. And again, this work is strategic in trying to build bridges with the scientific community. So the first paper is on interstellar colonization. I'm actually giving a talk in at the Kavli Astronomy Conference in Durham, England, in early or mid-April. So I'll be in April giving a talk on this.
That is about half an hour from where I live.
Oh my God. All right. Email me. I'll meet up with you. I'll have coffee or something. Yeah, I'll be there in mid-April. Amazing. And I'll be there for a week. And so I'm giving a talk on my simulations of interstellar colonization. And I basically simulated a million civilizations, and I keep track of which ones find Earth, and then I can look at their statistics of what it takes for a civilization to find Earth. So that's what I'm up to.
Yeah, I'll drop you a message on that. That is very
close. Yeah, we'll get together. That'll be fun.
Yeah, that'd be great. That was a bonus. And speaking of bonuses, you can listen to a little bit more of Kevin if you're on the paid feeds. You'll hear that follow straight on from this. Same on the YouTube paid feeds. You'll see it go straight on. If you're on the free feeds, thank you very much. That's all from us. But Kevin, let's carry on with a few more listener questions. That is all for this episode. Thank you very much for tuning in. Don't forget to leave the podcast a review on your chosen platform. Apple and Spotify do make a huge difference to the algorithm. If you're checking the show on YouTube, please don't forget to like and leave a comment on here as well. Any sharing you do is very much appreciated on any social media platform. And finally, you can listen to shows ad-free and sponsor-free in their glorious full versions by subscribing for less than the price of a coffee on Apple, Spotify, just search That UFO Podcast Premium, YouTube, you can sign up and be a member, or you can do that through patreon.com. Thank you very much for listening, folks.
It wasn't a tic-tac and not quite a saucer, more like a hubcap designed by Chaucer, a little baroque and quite steampunk, like Alice was playing bass for the Parliament.